and I'm going to read three cork haiku. The first is called Fireplace, Cork, 1597. Down North Main Street, high above us, a fireplace floats, excavated high. The second one is called Ship's Cannon, Cork, 1800. On the grand parade, a cannon sinks its muzzle deep into lost streams. Sheila McGig, Cork, no date. Way up Lavitt's Quay, a swift parting of stone thighs stuns the passing feet.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Richard. And next we have Grant Marsh.
This is not one of my own poems. This is a poem by a girl called Francesca Beard. I saw her performing in the in St. John's College in 2002. Her book's called The Millionaire of Near Ideas, which kind of describes me pretty well. Shrinked, wrapped conscience and a dry, clean soul. Now you use a new religion, rehabilitation. 12 steps and you hold ass up the ladder to clear skies, caught the non-stop express to over the rainbow, where your blue bird of liberty chants in a non-specific synergy. Oh, the group lifted your burden and now you are a lightweight. Now you breach the bridge between self and hate, pontificating on your altered state of emancipation. All that tension's gone away, and the rope you walked on, tight, usually, the noose you spun off from your own neck to lasso some herd-brained fool, you've traded in for a new leash of life. You've grown bland with slack, choosing contentment over friction, lacking the substance you used to abuse. I liked you better as a rabble-rouser. I liked you more as a mad carouser at the gates of pawn shops, nose pressed against the bars of old London, a wallower at waterholes, happy as Lazarus, dead drunk but still rising. I loved it when you turned the blowtorch of your mental processes against innocent bystanders. Innocent of fucking what, you said. I loved it when you blew the short fuse, amplified your views from bar stools, spewed your gut instincts out in the back seats of black cabs, rose like a shark to the bait, flayed the passing traffic with the skin of your teeth, cruising, cursing down high streets and the inebriant aisles of the Tesco Metro. I love you when you screwed anything that moved just because you could. I loved you when you felt so degraded the next day that you said, what's the bollocks point anyway? And did it again that night with the same new, same old, same old. I loved you because you fought with your back to the wall of cowardice and cynicism and apathy. I loved you because you took no prisoners but threw them the keys from the parapets before you turned and dived, heroic, into the next line. I loved you because you cried like a child at injustice and indifference and bad made-for-TV mini-dramas. I loved you because you thought that charity was ridiculous, but you'd buy a pint for a chiseling geezer that made you laugh, even though it was your last fiver and only 10 o'clock and you yourself were an alcoholic. I loved you for your lust for life and truth and other people's wives. At rehab, they cleaned you out. Sardonic irrigation. All your bitterness was hosed away in a warm spray of understanding. Whitewashed your dark side, and now you are whole. You are unrecognizable. They cauterized your wounds. It deadened your nerve. They sucked out the poison and with it your passion. Lobotomy comes to mind. They healed you up with the right old stitch up. If I were a true friend, I would be glad. Well, maybe. But the fire in your belly has died, having nothing to feed upon, dampened by some perverse irony that gave you life but took it away. It's good you love yourself. I'm not going to.
What's your name again?
Francesca Beard.
Is she a car quick?
No, she's from England somewhere, but she has a website.
Okay, okay. Very good. And next we have Rose Lincoln.
Right, the last time I was here, I did a poem that I said I was going to practice for performance. As the lights earlier to see one more person in the audience, but I'll do it anyway now. In the station. Heavy metal guitars on radio boom into hard iron ears from dark corners at the escalators where untrained skaters proudly perform with expression bragging coolness their simple tricks on the rolling steps. Or from yellow walkmen in black pockets of silver riveted leather jackets. White poodles of chic ladies with large red flower hats and elegant white gloves bark and get into fights with dark shadowed scrubby street tykes. Wearing heavy gold collars who belong to dirty old men sitting homelessly under the waterproof roofs of the overcrowded train station. Movie youngsters, styled in blue jeans, turn away from the tobacco hands, begging for money and love. Beer bottled hooligans, oozing the odor of hash with skateboards under their feet, and heavy metal booning walkmen in pockets of black leather jackets, try to attract the chic ladies and escape from the scrubby tykes.
Thank you, Rosalind. Thank you. And next we have Larry Cogney. Wearing a dress that yesterday someone else wore, she stands at a locked door. An old man shuffles. As a nurse speeds past, his hand flutters. A bird that returns to his lap curls the corners of his spring handkerchief, mutters about grain, the cost of foodstuffs. Giant TV blares the gravitas of soaps. Racks of Hello magazines, flagrant with youth, as they pose in beige interiors or by infinity pools. Thank you, Larry. Always a pleasure. And then next we have Charles. Is it Clarkson?
Clark. I started to worry about my meters. So this, in fact, is a short from last year's short, organized by Pat Copper, I believe, Monster Fossil, etc. An ocean. Sister, my kidneys are exploding. Nurse, my kidneys are exploding. A moment later, Jack Applegard turned his head away. It rested on the pillow. It was perfect. But Nurse Quigley did not believe it. "You've seen too many old movies, Jack," she said. Nothing stirred in the ward. Then she understood Jack had passed on. Her professional reaction was immediate. She pulled the curtains, but her shock was profound. She sat down next to the bed and wept. She wept uncontrollably, tilted forward. For a long time, she remained there. A houseman passed, stopped, came back and looked. He picked up the chart, which told him nothing, placed his fingers on Jack's neck. He was dead. He looked at Nurse Quigley, who turned vast, open eyes at him. Dr. Cable was a brilliant young man with literary interests. He thought, I must preserve the scene. His second thought was that Professor Scritch would be there shortly, doing a ward round, which he would join. What to do about Nurse Quigley? She was immovable as the chair in which she sat. Her uniform was unstarched, the bedclothes were damp, her tears recommenced. The professor came shortly afterwards, pink-faced, determined look, striped cricketing tie. He considered the cause of death and had let it go on. He asked Dr. Cable to describe the patient, whose eyes had not been closed. Little had changed since early morning, of rigor had begun to set in. Cable said so. He suppressed the urge to make a wild stab at diagnosis. The professor had, on one such a patient, diagnosed a rare disease without examining the patient. He did not do so now. He turned his attention to Nurse Quigley. She would have to go. He motioned to a young woman student. Together they lifted her from the chair and moved her with difficulty to the staff nurse's station. She muttered one word. Kidneys. A difficulty was unexpectedly resolved. Jack Appleward had left a will with a provision for a post-mortem. He had named the medical scientist who would perform it and specified the fee. It was kidneys, after all. Many days later, in the graduate students' lounge, a flood of illumination came to Cable. In the form of a literary illusion. Her eyes were an immense sea in which galleys were fleeing. Nurse Quigley was in full flight.
Thank you very much, Charles. And next we have your neighbor, Michael Ray.
Lemon drizzle. I like stripy blue tea towels and glass bowls of lemons in sun-mottled kitchens, the texture of life in the skin of a fruit as it gives up its zest. The oven door opened the smallest of cracks to measure the weather and check if it's risen. The sugar dust clinches, vertiginous kisses with passionate lovers who fold at the knees in the sintering heat when a freshly baked cake is tapped from the tin, takes skewer and juice deep into its centre. This art, it is ancient, a divine elevation, from a bowl-scraping spoon with a paddle-shaped heart to an empire of tastes. It is bittersweet water, whisked eggs and flour, and beaten in butter, set into a fire. It's the art of the senses, soft, warm and dripping, licked sticky fingers, almost a sexual thing.
Thank you, Michael. And then representing the very back of the room, we have Kevin.
All right, the very back.
I'd like to read two poems. The first is a joint effort by the girls down the back from the five-word challenge. They were all too shy to read it. Just remind yourselves, the five words are monkey, conscript, banana, withdrawal, and ritual. A ritual of withdrawal. A monkey eats a potato. A conscript eats a tomato. Nobody likes bananas, especially in the Bahamas. Wells of bliss. green like jade imperial. As they fall on me, my world grows still. Love and happiness, futures abound, but in the now, let's just end this.
Thank you, Kevin. And that was quite an interesting poem there from the ladies in the back. Shouldn't have been shy. Next we have Cedric.
So this one is titled Champion. I'm debating loudly, fiercely. My counterpart, not lacking arguments, systematically corners me. I'm not insane. I know I won't win an argument against the mirror. But still, I can make a point. While he looks away, lost in thought, I could easily read on his face. I ready myself for another day of work. I need to put the mask on. I will have to face them, these other others, wearing their own camouflaged expressions. I give him one last look. We have come to an agreement. We both know I'm right about everything. I've conquered myself, so I head out. I will conquer them all.
Thank you very much, Patrick. And next we have Rob Orkart.
From the occasional series, Things That Have Interested Me. I think it's probably 372. Anyway, this is Lytton Strachey, who was a member of the Bloomsbury set. This is a book by a guy called Michael Holroyd called Unreceived Opinions. It's basically literary reviews, basically. Anyway, this is Lytton Strachey. Aunt Aggie said she thought it would be a good idea to go to the Sphinx on camels. Directly she mentioned the word, 15 camels were on us, all making the most awful noise when sitting down. We were all seized by at least 4 men who pulled us in 4 different directions. I got to a camel and an Arab said it was a ladies' one, which it was not, so I was hustled off and 2 men came and lifted me into the air and put me on a camel. At this moment, the sheik interfered, and I got into the one that was supposed to have had a lady's saddle. It was rather a ghastly sensation when the camel got up and you thought you were going to tumble off. We walked on, our camels, to the Sphinx, where we dismounted and walked to a place just opposite its face. Although its nose had entirely gone, it looked as if all its features were there. What an exquisite face it is. How solemn, how majestic you look. Your eyes looking out into the desert with that beautiful expression always on your face. So colossal and so perfect. You, who have been here for thousands and thousands of years. You, who have gazed and gazed at that endless sea of sand ever since you existed. Tell me, oh tell me how to look with that sublime expression on your face. At all that comes and all that goes, careless of everything, forever.
Thanks, Rob. Before we go to the last poll of the list, are there anybody else who wants to read? That's some latecomers? No? Okay, Christy Parker, it's all yours.
Okay, see what's in the home for you. I got a poem here, which is the wrong one, so I'm pretty sure. It's actually autobiographical, but it's not about me. Does that make sense? It's about my dog. Years ago, a lot more years than I can remember, I used to race greyhounds because that would prompt the joke. Yeah, I used to beat them subjects too. But I used to own greyhounds and we used to race them. Now, I won kind of limited success. Some of them were quite good, and some of them, most of them were quite slow. One particular dog that was relatively fast, could beat his own parade, as it were. But he was kind of highly strong, and when he would be waiting in the traps for his race, he would get too excited because you see how the other race is going on. And by the time it came to his race, he'd be exhausted, and he'd be going to flop over the traps and follow the rest of them home. Still get fed, so I didn't care. Anyway, this is the volume for the dog's life, okay? There's a cure for this, by the way, and it's contained within the lyrics here. He was a brindle dog, a well-bred hound, but he never could win at the track, for the sound in his kennel of the hare going round sent him into a panic attack. He leaped from the floor and he chewed at the door, getting madder in that confined space, but barking obscenities and oaths by the score left him knackered before his own race. This bad situation brought a need for sedation. Alcohol, said a friendly bright spark, might ease his vexation and curb his frustration. Works for me anyway, he remarked. So I plied the poor dog with various grog in the hope I could get him to win. He turned up his snout at beer and at stout, but he waggled his tail at the gin. So one Friday night I supplied the cork dry. Before we set out for the track, he lay down in his kennel with a belch and a sigh before crashing flat out on his back. The gargle worked wonders, for by race number 8 he was sober and bursting with zest. He shot from the traps like a monk on a date and spit home 10 minutes later of the rest. But the very next morning, to my ultimate shock, the greyhound was gone without warning. I got phone calls to say he was down at the dock trying back gin and tonics all morning. The more races he won, the more nights he stayed out, and before long his life became sleazy. He was sniffing at girl with a mournful mouth, a bulldog from Killer called Teasy. But the bitch's bad breeding sent his life receding, as she soon brought my dog to his knees. He stopped earning his keep and took up chasing sheep, and was landlord to hundreds of fleas. He was gambling and smoking and rooting in bins. He was chasing cats up and down bars. Once I was told after 20 straight gins, he spent 7 hours barking at cars. Then one day he came home and stuck out his paw, and they knew he was no longer mine. He and Teasy had found a hay barn in Port Law to raise their first litter of 9. So if you have a greyhound a bit off the pace, be sure that you need my dire warning. Give him gin if you will, but don't unleash him to chase the hair of the man in the morning. Thanks. Just because it's about the one I shouldn't have taken over the train point in there, we just talked about tonight. It's far more serious, of course. It's actually about our childhood. It's about our childhood when we used to listen to fairy tales, and I've got an introduction to this one, so I'll read that as well, and I can make it all clear to you. So when we depart the childhood for the high road of adolescence, leading to the less colourful streets of the adult world, we're left behind many friends and characters. They lived in fairyland. It's nothing to do with Michael Jackson, by the way. And our parking would be prominent. Nonetheless, by a special secret tunnel, I revisited last week to check how all the gang had fared out, and I found that Cinderella joined her fella in his world of farming, but he turned out to be Prince Conman more than her Prince Charming. He lost his farms and pork hands and pawned her golden slipper. She left the fairy tale behind when she became a stripper. Little Red Riding Hood became a bitch when her grandmother's will made her pompous and rich. She purchased the wood, chopped every tree, and what's more, built ugly apartments to keep the wood from the door. After Snow White had snapped out of her trance, she divorced her Prince Charming and headed for France, where she sold her strange story about the lads who were small. Disney gave her $1 million, but the dwarfs got fuck all. Poor Goldilocks is now doing time, and again eating porridge for a terrible crime. She went back with a knife, the three bears left her in. When the cops finally caught her, she was wearing bear skin. Old Mother Hubbard had a doggy put down. She went looking for work all around town, but without any food and a cupboard so bare, she was easily employed as a cook with Ryanair. Jack and Jill are doing fine, while he was drinking water, but he filled the pail with beer and ale, and at the christening of their daughter, he staggered up the hill that day, and as far as Jill can tell, he left their lives with a nosedive into the bloody well. And finally, the three little pigs are doing okay, now that the law understands they are gay. They married each other, and with the wolf out of sight, I found him as happy as three pigs in shite. Thank you.